Aloha, Dave.
Hey, Steele, how you doing?
I'm doing fantastic.
I've missed you, Steele. I haven't been talking to you every day for the past week, and like there's a hole in my heart.
Yeah. You should get that checked out by a doctor. It can lead to arrhythmicardia or whatever it's called.
It's a major problem. You don't want a hole in your heart. Yeah, that's open heart surgery, probably.
Well, we are excited to bring you another episode of Off the Chain with Dave and Steele. We've got a lot lined up for today. We're going to look at a little bit of something we're going to call At the Limits, human capacity for amazing, essentially. We've got some small talk for you. I'm going to give you some things to talk about in your next awkward social interaction. We're going to talk about some of the great music that's hit us lately, a special segment of Unchained Melodies, and we're going to bring you some book wisdom. We've got a lot to pack in, so let's get started.
Steve, I like At the Limits. That's a great title for the segment. I love it.
I'm glad you approve. So, Dave, what's at the limits for you lately?
Oh my goodness. So I love this stuff. I love reading about human survival, just these people that push themselves to the limits and they're able just to keep going, I don't know, conquering the human spirit. A while back, I read about a guy named Ernest Shackleton. Have you heard of that guy, Steele?
It sounds vaguely familiar. Polar explorer, something like that.
Yes. He was in like the golden age of polar exploration when like these guys were like astronauts in the 60s. Like you couldn't be cooler than a guy going to Antarctica. And he went to Antarctica once, and then he wanted to put together an expedition. His goal was to get to the South Pole first. Someone beat him to it, but his idea then was, all right, I'll just go all the way across Antarctica. That was his goal for this mission.
So he's saying, I'm going to cover the whole continent of Antarctica from one end to the other.
Yeah, he's like, I got my dogs, I got food, I'm Ernest Shackleton, we're gonna do this.
What
And
time period are we
people,
talking about, roughly?
this is the early 1900s. This expedition actually left shortly after the start of World War I, so 1914. And you know, he puts an ad out and so many people are applying. Over 5,000 applicants want to be on this ship of 28 men to go to the South Pole with Ernest Shackleton. People are super excited about it.
Because they can win glory, or is it just the thrill of an adventure, or what is it, do you think?
I think it's the thrill of the adventure, and it's like today if a guy goes to the moon, except cooler. I don't even think we'd be as impressed today with a guy going to the moon as they would have been impressed with a guy going to the South Pole. I think like chicks galore, Steele. You go to the South Pole, like you're gonna do well with the ladies.
So is Shackleton like a famous guy already? Is he well known, or is he just some ambitious dude?
He's not that famous, but he is very ambitious. He's one of these kind of guys that keeps coming up with get rich quick schemes and they keep failing, but he's just kind of got this charisma to him that people are drawn to. So people are always investing in Shackleton. They're always thinking this guy's going to come out on top. And he never really does, but the charisma is just powerful.
I like it.
So all these applicants, and he just starts choosing guys. He chooses them by the look. He looks at them and is like, I like the cut of your jib, and you're in. And you know, they've got these huge application packets. There's scientists, there's all sorts of people trying to go. And Shackleton's just like, he'll take a look at you like once over, and like he knows if you're man enough to go to the South Pole or not.
So he just says, show me your jib, and they pull it out, and then once he sees their jib, he knows whether they're in or not.
Yeah, so he just wants to see. And still, I don't know exactly what a jib is, which is what would prevent me from ever being picked by Ernest Shackleton to go on this exploration that he went on. But so he ends up picking actually two crews of 28. There's going to be a boat that picks him up on the other side, and he and his crew, they get in the boat called the Endurance. And things go bad pretty quickly. They're trying to get down to Antarctica during Antarctic summer, which is in December, and they just can't get through the ice floes, and their ship ends up getting frozen in the ice. So the only thing they can really hope to do is hang out in the ship until the next year when the ice melts. And at this point, Shackleton still kind of wants to do his thing.
So they haven't even landed on Antarctica, but they're already stuck?
Yeah, they're like way out in the bay. They're hundreds of miles from Antarctica. And on this ice floe, there's no way you can get across this ice floe. It's too dangerous. You can't just strap the dogs in and go. So eventually, ice crushes the ship. So they have to abandon ship and live on ice. They live on this ice for over 500 days.
And how are they sending? How are they communicating to say, "Hey, come find us or save us"? Or how are people supposed to know to look for them?
It's 1915, still. No one knows. They just figure either they're going to get back or they all died. So there's no. That's the thing. They can't call for help. They've got to take care of it. And what's so cool about Shackleton is his leadership in this time. There's no talk of mutiny. There's no talk of cannibalism or anything. The whole time, everyone groups together. And Shackleton, just through his sheer charisma, keeps these groups together. And they end up, after being on the ice for over 500 days, they take boats on an open boat journey to the nearest place they can get, which is Elephant Island. This is kind of an insane journey to make, an open boat in the South Antarctic Sea to an island that's several hundred miles away. It's shocking that these guys survived this trip to Elephant Island.
Wow.
And that's not it. They're not, like, saved once they get to Elephant Island still, because they're still in major trouble. No one goes to Elephant Island. It's an uninhabitable island. They're still hundreds of miles from the nearest inhabited island. So what Shackleton ends up doing is he takes one of these boats, takes the other one apart, and kind of makes more of a ship, you know, just with the tools that they have on hand. And he's going to take this ship from Elephant Island to an island called South Georgia, where whalers camp. I read the book called The Endurance about this. I'd recommend it to anybody because it's super interesting. The book describes this crossing in way better detail than I can, but again, this has never been done, and this has never been repeated. It's not like someone in this day and age is like, yeah, let's try that out. No, you wouldn't try that out because you're going to die.
Right.
So they finally get to South Georgia, but the wind and the tide conditions are such that they can't land where the whalers land. They have to land on the opposite side of the island. Now, does that sound like a major problem to you still? Just landing on the wrong side of the island?
It depends on the size of the island, but it doesn't sound ideal. Although if you have a homemade boat and you've just come from failing to land on the Antarctic continent, it might be a little more promising than where you started. I don't know.
They feel pretty good about it, but it's been almost 3 years of living off of whatever they brought, whatever like seals they could catch and club.
And these guys are English, right?
Yeah, these guys are English.
So their food started off terrible.
They brought good food with them. When you think about the conditions in England, Antarctica is not that much worse.
So, porridge or frozen porridge? It's really your choices.
but they finally get to this island still, and they're on the wrong side of the island, and this island's got insane mountains. They have no climbing equipment. They have to make it with just a few short lengths of rope. There's three of them that have made this journey, and they've left the rest of them on Elephant Island to go save them. And Shackleton, of course, is captain of the ship because he's the leader. He's not going to make someone else do this. He's going to take all the risks. And so they make this climb from one side of the island. They've never been on this island before. Well, they have, but they've never been on this island to climb before. And they make this climb. Again, this is a climb that like modern day climbers would have a lot of difficulty with modern equipment, but they just have to do it. And eventually they make the climb. They're able to get boats to go to Elephant Island. They save. No one in this crew dies. Like people get frostbite, lose fingers and stuff, but no one dies. They return to England like actually heroes because they survived this terrible thing. But just the leadership of Shackleton, the fact that over 3 years he just maintains control of this group. He makes the decisions. And even though they're in just perilous circumstances the whole time, he gets them through.
And so it's 3 years later when they get back?
Yes.
So this is kind of a sweet move in that there's probably a lower mortality rate among this group than among an ordinary English town since they're all dying in the war. I mean, that's awful to say, but they had better odds going to the Antarctic than just staying in England, where they would have got shipped off to the trenches and killed.
And they come back famous. Like, people are like, everyone in this crew is famous. Shackleton's huge. I think he becomes a knight after this. Wow. Yeah, they made the right call.
Sir Shackleton.
Yeah.
Did anybody lose their jib, Dave? That's the crucial question.
Fortunately, no one did lose their jib. And if you look at pictures of Shackleton, like, he just looks like just a tough guy.
That sounds like, awesome.
You're not going to mess with this guy. He's got frostbite all over. Eventually, he goes back to the Antarctic again, has a heart attack down there, and dies. He just keeps wanting this Antarctic glory, and wow, got it. Like, I think he's a cool dude.
So, Ernest Shackleton, at the limits. I like it, Dave. So, I've got a guy for you. I'm not much of a runner. I'll run when I'm playing a sport, but I don't like running for pleasure. But I have been fascinated for some time by not just marathoning, but ultra-marathoning.
And Steele, you know, actually a friend of mine just came in, Ryan, and he's doing a marathon next week. He's way into running. So he might have some thoughts regarding some of the things you say here.
Okay, so we're joined by Ryan. Welcome, Ryan.
Hey, how's it going? Glad to be here.
Yeah, awesome. So ultra-marathoning. I've never done a marathon. I've never done a half marathon. But there are these guys who are into, internationally, not just marathoning, but like super running. And the undisputed, like, god, the record holder, the best of all time, is this Greek guy who lives in Australia. His name is Yannis Koros. And just to give you a sense of what he's done and what he's into, he currently holds like 200 world records for ultramarathoning. Some of them include, he has run 100 miles in the fastest amount of time. He's also the world record holder for running the 1,000 kilometers consecutively in the fastest time, and 1,000 miles in the fastest amount of time. And then also, they do timed races to see how far you can run in a certain amount of time. He holds the records for 12 consecutive hours, 24 consecutive hours, 48 consecutive hours, and the six-day record. It's kind of obscene. It's incredible. So if you were to estimate, how long do you think it might take you to run 100 miles?
Ooh, 100, to run 100 miles?
Yeah.
At least a week, I'd say. I'd go with 7 days.
Okay, 7 days.
I think, it's different for me because I actually plan on running 100 miles in the next couple of years. I'm working up toward it. I'm hoping to get it in under 24 hours. That's my goal.
Wow. Okay, so if you were imagining you did a marathon, which is like a quarter of 100 miles, what would be like your target time?
Well, for me, like Dave said, I'm running this week and it's my first marathon and I'm just aiming for under 4 hours. That would be my goal for this one.
So suppose you did one marathon in 4 hours and let's say you quadrupled it, so it would take you 16 hours running at a real good pace for you.
Sure, yeah.
Yannis Koros' world record, he did 100 miles in 11 hours and 46 minutes.
Oh, my gosh. Oh. See, what's astounding about that is that saying that I could run 100 miles in 16 hours is, like, ridiculous. There's no way that I can do that. Not on my best day, not in a year's time. And I would be really impressed with that.
And you would have finished five hours behind him.
Yes, exactly.
You could have watched like all the Lord of the Rings trilogy after he finished and then greeted you at the finish line.
Wow.
No, so this is incredible. And apparently the key for him, I read this great interview with him in Runner's World where he says there's a separation of mind from body as he's doing this. But the mind, he says, still gives commands to the body. So he says, this is a quote, "The pain is the reality, but your mind can inspire you past it. I look to the countryside, music, and art to help inspire me." He says his body speaks to him, saying, "Stop," or "Give me something to eat," or even "Take me to the hospital." But he just ignores it and tells the body to keep going. And so the other thing that's super incredible about him is that he can assimilate calories while he's running in a really incredible way. So he was doing a six-day race in Australia, and they were monitoring his caloric intake. They said on the first day he took in 15,000 calories while running continuously. The second day he took in 12,000, 3,000 the third day, or 7,000 the third day. And so he did this 300-mile run in Greece, and he took half of his calories from Greek sweets. He ate every 20 minutes. He ate stuff like baklava, fresh creamy custard, honey cookies, etc. He just didn't care. He's just like, I was just going to eat what I want. And he says he only loses weight in these races if he wants to. If he wants to, he could gain weight while he was running these like 6-day races.
It's amazing. It's like he threw anything in there, he just burns it up and no issue. For a lot of runners, you got to be really particular about what you're eating and use special running food and all that that's easy on the stomach. Make sure to get some proteins in there for long endurance races, but it sounds like he can just assimilate anything.
And I don't know, because I mean, some of it could just be bragging, you know, it could be part of his lore or his legend, but it sounds roughly true. The thing that's crazy about him is he holds the record for both these 12-hour and 24-hour races, but his rate, the speed at which he runs, is essentially the same. He runs 13.5 kilometers an hour in the 12-hour, 12 kilometers an hour in the 24-hour race. And here's the crazy part, the part that I said was that was most interesting. He says it takes him one day for his muscles and his feet to shrink back to normal after a 48-hour race. His feet swell from a size 9 to a size 11 during a 6-day race. And it can take a whole week to recover from a 6-day race. After the event, he says he sometimes feels what might be described as a little bit of depression. He says, I feel disappointed, a bit depressed after races, and feel I didn't accomplish much. But this inspires me to keep pushing. He just sounds like an insane man to me. The limit of what human beings can be in this one way.
And you know that the rate he's running these super long distances at is faster than what I do when I just go for like a 3-mile run. Like he would just blow me away.
It might even be faster than when I sprint.
Yeah.
Right, right. They did this this fun experiment where they drove around a truck in New York City with a treadmill and a harness, and they invited runners or anybody to jump on and run at basically world record marathon pace and see how long they can hold it. And most people can't hold the world record marathon pace for more than a few hundred yards.
Holy cow.
And they're doing it for 26 miles, you know?
Yeah. Human beings are amazing.
I have one more thing to add, Steele.
Sure.
I want you to know about, I ran a half marathon once. And I'm just going to tell you a little bit about it. The first 5 miles, great pace. I was feeling great. Like, things were going really well for me. I was smiling. I was passing everybody. No issues. Like, about 5 miles in, I start to get a little gurgle in my tummy. I'm not sure what I'd ate the last night or what I ate that morning, but the last, I guess, about 10 miles, 8 miles of the run, I had to stop in every possible location where there was a port-a-john, and I had to poop.
It's the striding of the legs, man. It loosens it up.
Runner's runs.
Is that what it's called? Runner's runs? Yeah. Good thing we have a pro in the studio today.
Oh, no, it's true. So, yeah, as you're running along, you're shaking everything down, so to speak. You know, winnowing it down further and further. And you're taking in water, and your stomach might be a little bit upset anyway from just the exertion or the change in scenery. And, you know, sometimes you get that on vacation. Yeah, runner's runs, man. After a few miles, sometimes it's too much for your other muscles to hold.
Well, welcome to the guild, Dave. I'm glad you got to enjoy that.
I love it. I did not love it.
It's the worst.
But you finished your half marathon.
I finished in a decent time, and for the next like 3 hours, I had to poop every half an hour, and after that, I was good.
Did you get a T-shirt or some kind of commemorative medallion, or what did they give you?
T-shirt, medal, and some chafing.
Yeah. I'm sure. Yeah. It could have been terrible.
So that's our new segment, At the Limits. So we're going to try to bring that back and bring you some more incredible human achievements sometime in the future. The next thing we want to talk about, small talk. This is a regular feature. You longtime listeners have probably recognized it. In small talk, remember, the basic principle is we want to give you something to talk about. You're going to have your mind armed with a couple of things. So the next time you come into a conversation where you want to impress someone or demonstrate your intelligence or your erudition, pull out one of these stories that we're going to share with you from Small Talk.
I got something good, Steele. Recently, we're going to go to Disney World in a little while, so I've been showing some of my girls old Disney cartoons, you know, from like the 40s and 50s, and they're hilarious. Chip and Dale going after Donald Duck. I'm literally sitting there, I'm laughing. It's awesome. And we recently watched one where it was Christmas in Donald's house. And apparently Donald's life is a little bit sad because he's just in there by himself with tons of presents and toys. He's opening stuff up, and he's just doing it alone. So Chip and Dale, they sneak in because they're going to play with his stuff and eat some of his like popcorn. And things just start to escalate real quickly. Very quickly, Donald is super angry at Chip and Dale. He wants to destroy them. And he's got some, like, play military toys and stuff, you know? And so Chip and Dale are putting on their little general uniform, shooting tanks. But they're shooting just, like, little balls and stuff. And Donald's getting mad.
He's weaponizing Christmas, huh?
That's exactly what he's doing. But it's all in good fun. It's all play. And you're all thinking, like, they're still buddies. And then all of a sudden, out of nowhere, Donald pulls out a real handgun still.
This is awesome for kids, huh?
And he's got the little six shooter and he's holding it right at Chip. And I'm like, what is going on? It was just like a playful situation. Suddenly, we've escalated to like someone's life is at stake here. It was fantastic. I told a lot of people about it. I guess it's just time changes and the cartoons and what's funny. Like, you couldn't possibly pull out a handgun in a cartoon now, but in like the 40s, that's just hilarious.
That's something. Ryan, what's your contribution to Small Talk this week?
Well, I was going to share an interesting story. It's weird that you talked about Ernest Shackleton. So I was going to talk about Simo Heha. He was a sniper in World War II. He earned the nickname the White Death. And he's got, I mean, they say, and you know with sniper stories, everything seems always like overdrawn a little bit, but apparently over 500 kills. What happened was the Russians were invading, and a lot of the guys just kind of picked up and left, and the town's partially abandoned. But he thought to himself, this is where I grew up. This is my home, and I'm a hunter, and there's got to be something I can do. He decided to make his own white camouflage, get his hunting rifle, some supplies,
ammo. And go kill Russians.
Just go kill Russians. Just kind of go to town.
So where is this guy at, and what's his name again?
Simo Heha. It's H-A-Y-H-A. And it's got, like, the umlauts, and so I'm probably totally butchering it. But, yeah, it was in Finland during World War II. So get this. Here's why he's called the White Death. He takes to the hills, and the Russians begin to occupy this town. And he starts to just give them harassing fire, picking off people here and there. And they're thinking, oh, okay, well, we're going to get this insurgency out of here. And so they send some guys into the hills to try to, like, take him out. Like, we'll flush this, you know, with this infantry out. And he kills every one of them. None of them return. And they're like, wait, maybe they got lost. So they send more guys.
Wait, are we sure this isn't a Vin Diesel movie?
I know. It's like, I'm surprised it's not an amazing movie yet. And I think there is a movie about it, but I haven't seen it.
The Finnish Predator.
Takes them on. So yeah, he kills them all, and then the Russians send more guys. This time they send many more. He kills them all. They think, oh my gosh, there's not just somebody up there. We have like a whole squad, or maybe a whole platoon up in the hills that we didn't know about. Our intelligence failed us here. We need to go flush them out. Well, he ends up getting spotted, and they think, okay, not only are we going to send a lot of guys up in the hills, but we're going to get specialty snipers who are counter snipers. So they send this crew of counter snipers after this guy, and yes, like you might expect, he kills every single one of them. The best part about Simo Heha is that at the end, when they ask, what made you do this? Like, why did you think you stood any chance against the invading armies? And he just says, well, I had a rifle and I had to do something.
It's just a shame that you don't have a lot of use for those skills in non-wartime, huh?
I'm making a script. I'm sending it to Diesel. I think we can get this made.
I have a gun. I had to do something. I had a gun.
That's a good Vin Diesel line I could hear. I think that's a kind of conversational anecdote that'd be especially useful with in-laws. You know, you're just making small talk with family members, especially, you know, the generation who remembers the Cold War, who's into that kind of stuff. You're like, oh, you think the Russians are bad? Let me tell you about someone who did something about it. Ooh. Simo Heha, right? What was his name?
Yeah, Simo Heha, or Heha, sorry.
And, Heha. Heha was his cousin.
One more thing you can sprinkle in there. He averaged over 5 kills a day. So think about those days where you're just watching Netflix, you know, he could have been, well, he killed over 5 people a day, and usually at night, and he preferred, get this, iron sights over any sort of telescopic lenses. So it just, the legend grows.
That's not a statistic that I ever want to hear cited again.
I know.
But thanks for introducing it. So I've got something that's of a very different flavor for my small talk. I read this really interesting New Yorker story about a mathematical problem that had been unsolved for like 150 years, I believe, or maybe even longer than that, that this loner mathematician, who's an adjunct professor at the University of New Hampshire, solved. The guy's name is Yitang Zhang. He had been working on it for 15 years. No one really knew that he was working on it, and then all of a sudden he publishes this paper that provides a massive, massive breakthrough, and the mathematical community is just blown away. It's this long feature story, but there's a couple of things that I thought were wonderful. They describe his office where he's working, where he makes this breakthrough, and here's the description. His office has a desk, a computer, 2 chairs, a whiteboard, and some bookshelves. The books on his shelves have titles such as An Introduction to Hilbert Space and Elliptical Curves, Modern Forms, and Fermat's Last Theorem. There are also books on modern history and Napoleon, who fascinates him, and copies of Shakespeare, which he reads in Chinese because it's easier than Elizabethan English. So he's just a guy in an office working on pen and paper, you know. The chair of his department doesn't really have any idea of what he's working on until he submits this thing and it becomes famous. He has this breakthrough while he's visiting a friend in Colorado.
Yeah, breakthrough. I'm now you got me. Okay. Like what's going to push him over the edge in this boring mathematical odyssey?
Yeah. I guess I was the only one fascinated by this story. So he's visiting his friend, and he's sitting around in the backyard. He was smoking a cigarette. He says, just walking and thinking. This is my way. For about a half an hour, he walked around, and then he says, I see numbers, equations, and something even, it's hard to say what it is, something very special. Maybe numbers, maybe equations, a mystery, maybe a vision. I knew that even though there were many details to fill in, we should have a proof. Then I went back to the house. He didn't say anything to his host about his breakthrough. He just keeps it to himself. His friend is a orchestra conductor, and he was conducting a dress rehearsal of a 4th of July concert in Pueblo, Colorado. So his buddy goes with him. And after the concert, he couldn't stop humming The Stars and Stripes Forever. And all he would say was, what a great song. And that's the only thing he communicated about his breakthrough. The other thing that I found fascinating about this was he got his PhD at Purdue, and his dissertation director wouldn't write him letters of recommendation and kind of didn't help him find jobs. And after this breakthrough came, the dissertation director wrote up his memories about this guy. And he says, some people believe that mathematicians are weird. I think differently. All the mathematicians I know are quite normal. Yitang was a normal person for those 7 years at Purdue. And this follows this description of how, like, this guy will go for weeks without talking to another human being. He, like, shuns social contact. So just a kind of frame of reference for how this dissertation director thinks is normal. But later on in the thing, he describes this guy and says, I told him the normal way of seeking jobs. When I looked into his eyes, I found a disturbing soul, a burning bush, an explorer who wanted to brave thunders and lightnings to reach his destination. Yitang never came back to me requesting recommendation letters. Apparently, he did not seek a job. Even to the date Yitang announced his monumental result, I did not know what was the best for him. Though I was sure of one thing, he could not survive the life of tenure track, tenure, and promotions. It was not his type. I regarded him as a free spirit, and I should let him fly. Yitang flew away after he told me that he was going to Rutgers University. I bade him good luck. That was almost 22 years ago.
Wow.
That's beautiful.
Wow.
So tying it back in, he's the mathematical Ernest Shackleton.
He took it to the limits.
Yeah. 15 years in the wilderness and came back with this proof.
What I really liked from that was kind of the description that he had this moment, this kind of moment of clarity or insight, like an awakening basically happened to him where he had his breakthrough. Steele, have you ever had an experience like that in your life?
I don't know. Probably. I felt this enormous sense of relief after finishing my prelim exams, but it wasn't so much that I got a sense of breakthrough as a sense of someone said, you did this and you passed, you don't have to do it again. So it's kind of an external validation rather than an internal one.
I can relate to that. I can think of a moment like that, and it was actually math-related, but it's so incredibly pathetic compared to his. I was in, I think, 10th grade, and I had not studied for the a test that was coming up. Not like I should have, and when the test time came, because I was just overly confident about, I'll be fine, but when the test came, I did not recognize much on the test, and I sat there trying to work things out. People were getting up and finishing and leaving, you know, and it gets to be where everybody's gone pretty quickly. I'm the last one. I'm just sitting there plugging away at this test, you know, taking all the way up till the end. And then my teacher says, all right, you got 1 minute left. And when I hand it in, I tell her, I look her in the eye and say, I just taught myself all those concepts. And then I hand it to her and she says, well, you got to learn it sometime. And I ended up getting like an 85% on the test. I was really happy about that, but there were these breakthrough moments where I just, like, trying to sort out, you know, what was being asked and how I might go about doing that. I figured it out, but man, it's so lame. I could have just studied, you know?
I can only imagine that teacher thought how ungrateful you were. You just taught yourself? What have I been doing the last 3 months?
Exactly.
I think I've experienced this to a much lesser degree, probably many times, but one just simple example is I'm studying to be a nurse practitioner, so anytime a sick patient walks into the exam room, I have to try and figure out what's going on. And when I do reach that moment of clarity, yeah, you know, usually it's like, oh, he just has a cold. But sometimes it's more than that. But it's a good feeling when I feel like I know, okay, this is what's wrong with this person.
So like the diagnostic moment.
Yeah, like I don't love medicine or medical practice. I like it. It's not like my passion, but just that moment is pretty great. Like
that sounds awesome.
Where you figure out this is what's wrong, and now I can help you because I figured out what's wrong.
We had a really similar experience actually this week with our baby, Dave. He's 11 months old now, and we've been having these persistent feeding problems, and we've gone to see specialist after specialist, all these doctors, and we've had a series of sort of diagnoses, but that don't explain the symptoms that we're observing. We did this barium swallow test, and they saw during one of the swallowing tests of liquids that he was aspirating. That explains, and not every time, but it helps us explain. We're like, oh, one of the reasons why he might not be drinking while he's awake is because he might be swallowing some of that liquid into his air passages, coughing it up, and it's uncomfortable. He doesn't want to drink while he's awake because he associates it with this unpleasant sensation. When he's asleep or relaxed or more, then he's less likely to aspirate is what we're assuming. That felt like a huge breakthrough and such a relief where we found like, okay, we have something like a physical explanation and a tentative diagnosis for what we're observing and that we have been observing that's been causing these problems. I can't express like how much that made a difference just psychologically for us.
Yeah, just the peace of knowing what's going on. Like, even if like you don't immediately have a solution how to fix it, but just knowing this is the issue, yeah.
It's huge. So that's our small talk. Next time you want to talk about explorer mathematicians, the White Death, I think was his name.
Yes.
Or Chip and Dale and the handgun. I mean, it all ties together. Violence, danger, thrill. Donald Duck was taking a page out of old Hoo-Ha's book.
Hoo-Ha, yes. I'm sure that was his nickname in high school.
Yeah. It's like a Busta Rhymes song. Speaking of Busta Rhymes, let's do a little bit of Unchained Melodies.
Okay, great. I want to share then her name she goes by is Waxahachie. And I just heard this song a few weeks ago. I've heard some of her music before, and it just seemed a little bit dour, just a little bit too down for me. And then I heard this, and it was just like fresh air. It's called Under a Rock.
1, 2, 3. Maybe you got your head cut in a ditch last night. I got to you in parting. Now you're someone else's mess tonight. And I gotta say, I told you twice that I know how to break inside you. Look how fast you
So yeah, it's just, it's got a real pop feel to it, which I love. I love that it's just real catchy. After the second time I heard it, I was singing along.
I like that too. The kind of, it's got that grungy, dirty guitar sound, but there's the melodic tones are provided kind of through her vocals, really, in a kind of aggressive way. It's a nice track. So Ryan, we were thinking we want to go all female vocalists today, and I think you've got a London Grammar song lined up for us. Tell us about this one.
I wasn't even that familiar with London Grammar. I got invited to go see them, and I was loving their music, but then this song came on, and I recognized it, and I loved her version of it, because it's originally by an artist called Kavinsky, and I guess it's off a movie called Drive. I haven't seen that movie, but yeah, I love her rendition of the song. It's a lot more haunting and more human. The original's really digitized, so thank you for go.
So this is London Grammar, Night Call.
I'm giving you a night call to tell you how I feel. I'm gonna drive you through the night down the hills. I'm gonna tell you something you don't want to hear. I'm gonna show you where it's dumped, but have no fear. Something inside you is hard to explain. There's something inside you, boy, and you're still the same. I'm giving you a night call to tell you how I feel.
I love that there's kind of that deep, bassy tremulousness to her voice. It's pretty brassy, almost. I like that. So tell me about London Grammar.
They're from England. You know, honestly, I don't know tons about them. I know that they were great live. She's got a really powerful voice. I'd say that's a pretty representative song of their style. They throw in a little electronic stuff. I mean, they do acoustic as well. They're really a well-rounded band, really talented.
That's nice. It's kind of that slow building. It sounds a bit of like the XX instrumentation, and her vocals reminded me of Zola Jesus a little bit there.
Yeah, I'd agree.
So I'm going to take us a little bit further into continental Europe with mine. This is a woman from France. Her name is Mina Tyndall, and this song is in French. It's called L'Astrakhan. Fastest to slowest there. We're putting people to sleep with our female vocalists.
I'm about to nod off, but that, yeah, beautiful voice. I don't know if I told you this deal before, but I didn't really care for female vocals very much at all until I had daughters. Now, pretty much, I listen to it 80% of the time. I love women singers. I don't know. Maybe my heart just needed to grow.
You got Grinched, Dave. Your heart was three sizes too small, and now it's just right.
It's really funny to hear, because for me, I love, and I didn't realize this until I was going through my music, but I love basically electronic indie female vocalists. If I go through like my favorite bands, I'm finding a lot of that. So I don't know what that means, but
I was thinking about my taste, and I like female vocalists quite a lot, but I especially like males who sing in falsetto. So I guess castrati I'm really into.
Nice.
Anyway, maybe we shouldn't say that. I might cut that out later. But so that's Unchained Melodies. As always, we want to take you out with a little bit of human enrichment. This is going to be book wisdom. And since we were sharing stuff from the mathematical scientific realm earlier, there was a Danish polymath, a scientist named Piet Hein, I believe is how you pronounce it. And he wrote these small aphoristic poems that he called Grooks, G-R-O-O-K-S. And I'm going to read a couple of his Grooks, which I think are really wonderful. Here's one he calls A Psychological Tip. Whenever you're called on to make up your mind and you're hampered by not having any, the best way to solve the dilemma you'll find is by simply spinning a penny. No, not so that chance shall decide the affair while you're passively standing there moping, but the moment the penny is up in the air, you'll suddenly know what you're hoping. This one's probably my favorite in terms of its positive content. It's called The Road to Wisdom. The road to wisdom, well, it's plain and simple to express. Air and air and air again, but less and less and less. But the overall best one, and this one's for you, Dave Jensen. This called Dream Interpretation. Simplified. Everything's either concave or vex, so whatever you dream will be something with sex.
I did really like The Road to Wisdom. To me, that's a basic explanation of life and what we're doing here. Yeah, well, thank you for sharing that.
Well, thanks for joining us this week, Ryan.
Oh, and pleasure's all mine.
Dave, buddy, we'll talk to you soon.
Yeah, I'll see you, man. Off the chain. It's off the chain. I'm not here for your face. I'm not here for your looks, Steel. I'm here for what's inside your heart.
I'm here for your looks.
He's here for my jib.